Let's play some cards.
I wanna hold them like they do in Texas, please.
This is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and professional broadcaster Paul Harris.
You're good, kid, but as long as I'm around, you're second best. You might as well learn to live with it.
You got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them.
Now, here are Dennis and Paul.
We've got three good young players for you as guests. We recorded all of them a little over a month ago at the beginning of this year's World Series of Poker, as things are winding down now to the November 9, which will actually be the October 9 this year. We thought we would reintroduce you to Matt Affleck and Ari Engel and introduce you to Asad Goodarzi, who is making his first appearance on our show. The latter two are both online training pros, and Matt, of course, had a couple of deep runs in the main event in 2009 and 2010. Before we get to those interviews, though, just one quick note about the show. This will be our last Final Table show before we go on hiatus. Not sure exactly how long that hiatus is going to be while we continue to look for a new sponsor for the show. We appreciate the support of everyone who has listened to us and downloaded us or streamed our podcasts in the last 3.5 years. 181 shows under our belt. We hope to be able to come back and do more of those for you later on in 2012 or early in 2013. If you stay subscribed via iTunes or Stitcher Radio, then when the show comes back, you will get them automatically. Of course, you can always, every once in a while, check on our website, finaltableshow.com, to see what's going on with the show. So, now, let's go to our first interview with Matt Affleck, who had 2 cashes this year at the WSOP and 7 in previous years, including those back-to-back deep runs in the main event in 2009 when he finished 80th and 2010 when he finished 15th. And here he is back for another summer at the WSOP and in better shape than ever. Matt, welcome back to the Final Table.
Thank you for having me.
I guess the first obvious question, you've gotten yourself in shape. You look great, by the way. Is that because of poker or just because of you wanted to get in shape, and or has it helped or affected your poker any? Just out of curious.
Mostly because I just wanted to get in shape. I got a trainer a couple of years ago and been working with him off and on, and now it's kind of just a lifestyle change. So it's a lot more working out, eating healthier most of the time, and feel like I have a lot more energy and focus at the table, so it definitely helps when you're sitting for 8 hours that, you know, you've gone to the gym beforehand, and so I try to make it a focus before any tournaments to make sure I hit the gym before that. So,
cool.
So with that kind of discipline, does that mean that you have rules about when you're going to drink, when you're going to party, et cetera?
In Vegas, there's no rules, right?
Well, you know, for a lot of pros, it's very important, especially if you're going to be playing a lot of events. You know, you can't be up until 5 o'clock in the morning if you got to come back here and play your best for 12 hours at noon.
Yeah, that's one. This year I'm making sure the nights before events I'm in bed by, like, midnight, and I'm up by probably, like, 8:30 to be in the gym by 9:30. So no drinking the nights before events, but some of the off nights where I'm not playing the next day, you know, that's when I'll go out and have some fun in Vegas. But it's mostly a business trip, so I'm going to be playing a lot of poker, so probably a lot of 60-hour weeks.
A business trip.
Well, and actually he's right, but just out of curiosity, you've been to Vegas a few times now, you've seen some of the sights. What do you do on your off nights? Is there a particular place you go, shows you like to see, and what just a nice meal?
A lot of my off days, I golf a lot. I'm a big golfer.
Who's on the plus side between you and Matt Savage?
Oh, Matt Savage by far.
He owns you, doesn't he?
Our friend has a rule, is never bet with Matt Savage. I've broken the rule and I was punished for it.
So besides golf, what else?
I like going out to bars and just hanging out. Not a huge club guy, but just anything that's low key and just have a couple beers. So
the shows in Vegas?
I've been to a few. I like the Cirque du Soleil. I've been to a couple of them. Not a huge show guy, but I've liked those ones for sure. I haven't seen what kind of concerts and stuff they have going on during the World Series, but I'm sure I'll go to one of those. And just kind of whatever pops up.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about
let's go back to poker
here. When I looked you up in the Hendon Mob database today, I didn't realize this the last time we talked, but I saw that in your career, you played mostly tournaments with buy-ins of 500 to 1500. Every once in a while, though, you spring for something like a 25K high roller at the PCA or, you know, the 10K for the main event, which you cashed in
twice. So how do you choose where do you spend your bankroll, and what makes you go, okay, let's see, $1,020, $1,600, $25K?
Well, I took a lot of stupid shots after some big scores. But the 25K, I didn't have a huge percentage of myself. I only had, like 20% of myself, so I put in 5K of my own money.
Uh-huh.
But the 10K WPTs, I never have all my own action. I sell off pieces a lot, and actually now I have a backing deal. So all those, I'm not playing on my own money. But my kind of theory always has been, like, your whole year is you can't really count on six-figure scores, and you're not going to make, you know, 150K, 200K scores at the World Series, but like LAPC during the, you know, all their $500 prelims that are all 20K, you know, first place prizes. I feel those are the events that you're going to find a lot more success. And those, you know, if you can get three or four of those every year, which is very attainable if you're playing a lot of those $300 and $500 events, it's very attainable, you know, to have a couple of, you know, top five finishes and get some 20K scores. Those are where you make your year. That's my theory. I don't know if it's right or wrong, but I think it's a lot more obtainable in those events, and especially, you know, when they're 200-person fields. You're going to go deeper a lot often, and the fields are softer. So
like on a circuit event, do you go to play those $300, $500 ones and try to do those?
Lately, I haven't played the World Series circuit events. This next season, though, I'm going to try to play a lot more of the World Series circuit events and get into the free roll. A lot of it is just I base kind of my travel off of sometimes like destinations that I want to go to, and sometimes Council Bluff, Iowa doesn't sound like the best place to travel to every once in a while. I've never been, so I guess it's not the best
thing. But you can come to St. Louis if we have it there.
Yes,
next
I've
year.
Heard that event is actually huge.
Yeah,
and I know
it
they
was,
just had
yes.
the they had the HPT there, and that was massive, I heard. Yeah. So I'm going to start playing, try to play some more of those, and definitely the circuit events and still some of the WPTs and stuff.
We get a lot of questions about backing deals and staking deals. Most of them are, can you back me, can you stake me? Both Dennis and I get this. Dennis a lot more than I do. And I know you don't want to give away your own personal deals here, but can you give our listeners a general idea of how these kind of things work?
They're becoming few and far between.
Yeah. Right?
Especially after all the stuff that's happened lately, it's a lot harder to get a deal. I didn't think I'd have much problem, and then once I started looking for a deal, I realized everyone's like, well, I'd love to, but I'm cleaning out my stable and waiting for them to get out of makeup so I can stop backing people right now.
Uh-huh.
It's just the money flow right now is so hard. It's you're having makeup, people in makeup for 1-2 years, you know, at
explain,
a time.
Explain what makeup is.
Makeup is, so say you play a $5,000 tournament and you lose your $5,000 in makeup. It's money you owe the guy, but you're never going to owe that out of your own pocket.
So he puts it up.
Yeah.
And you're supposed to pay him back out of your winnings first.
So you lose one $5,000 event, your $5,000 in makeup. Next day you play another $5,000 event in cash for $20,000. You've had $10,000 in buy-ins, which is your makeup. He gets that back, 100% of that, and then you split the $10,000 profit 50-50.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's basically, I mean, my kind of theory now is that even if you're backed or not backed, you're always in makeup. Because either you owe the money back to yourself either way. Just because you lose $100,000 and win $100,000, you just didn't win $100,000.
Right.
You cleared all your makeup from before. That's like the biggest thing with poker is people don't realize, you know, they lose for 2 weeks straight and then they win money. They're like, yay, I won. It's like, no, you didn't. You just won back your losses. So.
I take it even a step further. I think you have to include in that your actual personal expenses, too.
Yep.
If you're flying somewhere, if you're staying in a hotel, you're whatever
That's
the heck,
all.
Those are all poker expenses, and that has to come out of your winnings.
Exactly.
And so go on from beyond the makeup. So then there are the percentages of how much you get to keep. What's fairly standard for a player, maybe not somebody who even has a record of success like you do, I mean, are people going to get anything where they're going to get more than 50% of what they win?
I've heard of a few, very few 55, 45s, and that's the best I've ever heard.
And what's the worst? Are there deals where somebody might only keep 20% of their winnings?
If you're in a full makeup deal, I don't think so. I think there's a lot of 40, 60 deals out there.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not exactly 100% sure on that, but I know a 50-50 deal is pretty hard to come by right now. So
50-50 is a very good one. I have heard up to 70-30, and I think the people who are doing the 70-30 were desperate because nobody else would back them for anything better than that. And I'm not for sure I'd want to back somebody who had to get a 70-30 deal.
70% for the backer, 30%
correct.
For the player.
Correct.
Sign me up for a 70-30 in my favor.
And so who are the people who are doing this? We heard of these guys, Bax and Sheets, who Put Joe Catta in to the main event a few years ago. Are there professional poker players who are now backing other professional poker players? Who do they tend to be?
My backing deal is with someone that no one would know. It's someone from Seattle. He backs me and one other guy.
Mm-hmm.
And we're both, because we both play in the same games as him, basically. And so, but I know there's, you know, the backs and sheets that everyone knows. There's some people are more public about it than others. And so, I don't know, it's kind of one of those businesses where it's, you know, you ask permission if you can talk about it. I know me and my backer, we're both on the same page. We don't, it doesn't bother us either way if we're talking about it. So, but it's kind of a private industry where it's no one really knows. All this money's passing hands and kind of stuff. Behind the scenes, people don't know what's all going on.
Yeah.
So people at home are watching TV and they're saying, oh, this kid just won $300,000. They might not know that, oh, he was $200,000 in makeup and only got $50,000 of it.
But right.
So there's a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff that a lot of people at home might not realize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the bad aspect of it is, again, there are people that are in makeup that will never get out of makeup.
Definitely.
That's the bad part. They literally...
Even worse, they leave in makeup. They just say, oh, I'm not going to play anymore because...
Yep.
So...
Yeah, and then the backer just gets screwed?
Basically.
Pretty much.
I know I've heard of deals where it's... So say you get deeper into makeup, say you get into $100,000 in makeup, which if you're playing $5,000 and $10,000 events is not much at all. I've heard of some backers that will be like, all right, you're not going to play the $5,000 events anymore. Now you're only going to play $1,000 max buy-in. They make you work harder to grind out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that can be demoralizing to the players. Like, oh, I'm never going to be able to make money for myself. And then they decide, well, I need to make money, so I'm going to go play on my own now again.
And they put their own money in there, and then they don't pay the backer back?
I've heard of stories like that.
Absolutely.
So.
Wow.
And it's kind of a question mark thing, because if it is your money you're putting in there, are you entitled to it? Or because this other guy's backed you for 6 months or a year or whatever, should a portion of that go back to your backer?
Well, I would think if you owe somebody $100,000, but you owe them $100,000 wherever you get it from.
Yeah, I agree. But, I mean, every few months there's a story that pops up. So
there is.
You just go, how could that ever happen?
And
it does.
Technically, if he's not buying you into the tournament, you're not obligated to pay him out of it. Morally, you may be. I would think you would. I would think it would be horrible if you did make a cash and didn't give him something at least out of it. But, you know, if you put your money up, you know, you're not obligated to pay the backer back, actually.
And are these things that are written down, or is it a handshake deal?
I know there's a lot of handshake deals. We do a contract before every series, and I wouldn't do it any other way.
I think that's wise, very wise.
Probably helps with tax stuff at the end.
Yeah, I mean, we have records of everything, and so it's records of how much money he gave me for the series, you know, how much money I paid back to him at the end of the series. And
Well, I hope you didn't mind going into that. Because
I don't mind it either way.
We get so many questions about this. I mean, a week doesn't go by where we don't get an email from somebody who either, you know, like I said, wants money or wants to know how it works. So I appreciate you going into
that. Most of my emails start out, I'm really crushing it in my home game. And so I would like...
First instance of a no answer right there. When they have to describe what they've done, that's when it's a no right away.
So, Matt, last time we talked to you, you were talking about the 5-10 games in Seattle that you were playing. I read on your blog that sometimes you're sitting down in, you know, 2-5 games or 1-2 and 2-5 PLO. Are people surprised when they see you in low-limit events since they may have only known you from playing in the 10K main event at the World Series of Poker?
Yeah, I get it a lot. People, it gets kind of annoying at times. They're like, oh, why aren't you playing, you know, there's a 10 and a quarter PLO game. Why aren't you playing that game? It's the biggest game. Well, it's a huge game. It's people are swinging 20K each way in that game. It's just, I don't know. I've learned through mistakes probably just, I've learned the value of just, you know, hey, if I can make $500 variance free, it's like in a lot of those lower six games, it's, you know, I'm going 7-8 sessions without losing, and it's like even when I am losing a couple in a row, I'm only losing a couple of buy-ins, and I've learned to appreciate just, you know, being able to make, you know, $500, $1,000, and just, you know, take it small chunks at a time instead of shooting for the big score every time. So.
This is crazy talk.
No.
A poker player making sense.
But the other thing about it, a lot of times when you go to a casino and they have one big table, and those are the grinders that are there 3 or 4 or 5 times a week, or a couple of the pros that have come in and that's where they're sitting, you look at the other table and you don't recognize anybody at the table. And it's so much I mean, it's no comparison. If I'm going to sit and play a 2-5 or a 10-25, and the 10-25 has three or four pros and a couple of grinders that are local there playing it every day, versus a table over here has a couple of weekend warriors, let's see, which one do I want to go to?
Yep.
Duh. I want to make – this is a business. You want to make money.
It's probably my biggest improvement as a poker player in the last year, year and a half, is I've done gotten really good at taking ego out of everything, I think. And
very good point. Very good point.
Something that's really hard to learn, especially as a young player. And I got, I mean, I won't lie, I came into a lot of money really quickly, and I wasn't that good before. And I'm a lot better player than I was in the past, I think. And I just, you know, thought I was king of the world, and I was going to, you know, have a 500,000 tournament score every year, and
right.
This is going to be easy living.
But reality hits.
Everything happens for the best, so I'm happy right now.
During the circuit event a couple of months ago, I was talking to a touring pro, and I asked him if he plays cash games when he busts out, and he goes, he plays WPT and WSOP circuit stuff all the time. He says, yeah, I go in the cash games. You know what I do? He says, I don't care what the stakes are. I look for the table with the most beers on it, and I sit down there because that's the game that I know is going to be the most profitable for me that day.
Yeah.
Particularly after playing, you know, 6 or 7 hours or 8 hours of a tournament, he's not going to be putting in a long session. So if he can make 500 or 1,000 bucks in a couple of hours, that's going to be a good day for him.
You do that 300 days a year, then, you know, you're making a pretty good living.
Yes,
but
you are.
The other thing, the mental about it, I love if you get knocked out of a $500, $1,000 tournament, whatever it happens to be, you go over and play cash, you get that money back, you broke even for the day.
Yeah,
it's a mental thing,
part,
too.
You know, if you play a 10K event and bust, you can't really get it back in a day. It's very tough to.
It's
you
tougher.
Play a 500, you can break even, still make money for the day. You
heck
know?
Yeah.
That's right. So this summer at the series, are you doing anything besides No Limit?
I'm just playing No Limit events this summer. I've been working on mixed games, but I haven't really gotten into the tournament aspect of playing mixed games and stuff. And so I kind of gotten the, I just think hourly rate and playing just, I'm playing 18 No Limit events, and I just think my time is kind of spent otherwise playing sit and goes and cash games on the other days. Like today I play 08, and I think I'm a decent, like I could hold my own in like a 40-80 08 game probably. But I think just in the tournament, and I don't know, I know there's different nuances with the tournament limit games, and I just think I'm better off, you know, playing in the cash games. And also, I can make money on my own then. My back row is this, so it's, you know, I'm playing that tournament, I'm playing on my deal, and so it's kind of nice to play cash games on my own. I'm putting money into my own pocket and stuff, and so have a lot of off days this year, and I like that, so I can play cash games and stuff on my own.
Talk about, for our listeners' benefit again, talk about the sit-and-goes here at the series, which you've gotten to know fairly intimately, I understand, over the last couple of years.
I dream about them all year, waiting for
yeah.
for this 2 months
they are
so I can
sweet.
Play 100 of them in 6 weeks.
What makes them so good?
People are awful. People raise with 5 big blinds to 2 big blinds and then fold when you shove on them.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's just you see stuff every time. You're like, no, they can't be doing that, and they do it. Awful.
At every buy-in level?
Yeah. Especially even sometimes at the higher ones. Sometimes at the 1Ks you get the real gamblers. So
that may be the case, but I love going over there and playing like the 3 to the 500.
Yeah,
1,000 is a little tougher a
yeah,
lot
I
of
agree,
times.
Yeah, I agree. I've played some very good 1,000s. A lot of the times they are tougher. I think the best ones are the 500s. I'm going to play a lot of the – you'll see me playing a lot of the 275s, three and a quarter I think they have. I forget what the exact buy-ins are. But.
Yeah, but those are great because, in my opinion, when you sit down to it, you've got the 10 people around the table. There's always 2, 3, 4 of them that you know are going to give the chips to somebody. And then if you can get down – and I love doing this. You get down to two-handed or three-handed and then chop it and you move on to the next one.
Yep.
The way you go, it's fantastic. I love those sit and goes.
There was a point last year when I was playing the 500s and I was actually – I figured out a system where I was playing 2 at a time where I would wait until, like, I forget what the exact blind structure was, but once it hit, like, 100, 200, I'd register for the next one. And then by the time I, you know, unless I got, like, heads up,
yeah.
I would be going to my next table and it'd be, like, 50, 100 blinds. And I'd miss, you know, one meaningless kind of orbit. And so I'd have no downtime in between each sit and go.
Wow.
And I'd tell the table I'm in for whatever lasts longer, just put me in it. And then we'd
away you go.
So you were really grinding. How many would you get in a day?
I mean, if I played for like, I forget, they play that take like 2 hours for the 500s about. And so, you know, my average time in each one is probably maybe around an hour if you account the times you get busted right away or get heads up. So, I mean, I was getting about one in an hour I mean, on average. So.
Wow. And you do six or seven or eight of those, and there's your workday right
yeah,
there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I tried to explain to a guy last year about the chopping, and he says, well, yeah, but I like heads up, you know. And you're missing out on the next tournament. If you make it down to heads up and you're fairly decent, the guy's a solid player, screw it. Chop the thing, you move on to the next one where you have it. That's my opinion of it. I don't know what you like to do, but
I go 50-50 both ways on it a lot of times. I'm a tough negotiator in chops. I'm very stingy about giving up equity and stuff, and I don't mean it, but I mean if I get a deal that I like, I'll take it. If they're reasonably and they know how to push fold and stuff, I'm probably going to chop it because it's heads up. With eight big blinds,
exactly.
A lot of variance.
Yep.
So,
yeah.
And a lot of it depends. If there's another sit and go going up with three seats left, then I'm more likely to chop it. If they just started one and it's going to be another 30 minutes so the next one runs, then I'm probably more likely to play heads up.
Yep.
So kind of just mood goes into a lot of it. Sometimes I kind of don't want to play heads up. It's different. You don't get to do it that often. So
I told a story about a couple of years ago being in one of these 525 buy-in sit and goes and getting down to heads up with a guy who was just an annoying person. I mean, forget about his poker skills. He was just annoying.
There's a lot of them
to
over
everybody.
There.
Yeah. Yes, there are. And when it got to heads up, I said, do you want to chop it? He said, yes, 75-25. And I said, you have 11,000 in chips, and I have 9,000 in chips. That's even. Why would I give you 75-25? He said, 75-25 or nothing. I said, okay, nothing.
Yeah.
And three hands later, I had all the chips. Okay, bye.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's very dependent on who you're playing and what their skill level is. But sometimes chopping and moving on can be lucrative.
Yeah. And I take the kind of the approach with chopping is, I mean, if someone offers me a deal I don't like, I won't get offended or whatever. I hope they're not getting offended if I offer a deal they don't like. And I don't think people should get offended. Just say, you know, no, I don't want that and play then.
Right.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I think people get very offensive in chop deals. And actually, I'm understating it. People will get angry, and sometimes that's good. Then, if you offer something, you're not, you know, I might in a $500 sit and go where we're heads up, and I think I have a decent advantage. I might ask for another $100 or $200 or something, which isn't, if we're even in chips, might not be. It's probably fair if I think I have an advantage, and then they just start screaming at you and yelling at you and stuff. And it's like, you know, I'm being respectful. I'm sorry if you don't like the deal, but just. You don't need to scream and yell, you know. And
oh,
stuff.
And by the way, now that you're on tilt, let's play.
Yeah, exactly. That's part of it. It's kind of the whole mantra too, of some people won't chop and cash game the blinds because it will tilt the other players, and then they just they spew off, and I've seen it a ton of times.
Nice to see you, Matt. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Matt Affleck joining us here at the final table with our continuing coverage of the 2012 World Series of Poker. With Dennis Phillips, I'm Paul Harris. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. You can get all of our podcasts at finaltableshow.com or download them via iTunes and Stitcher Radio. We are continuing our coverage of the 2012 World Series of Poker here at the Rio in Las Vegas on the Final Table Poker Radio Show with Dennis Phillips. I am Paul Harris, and our guest now is poker pro and poker coach Ari Engel, who has won three gold rings on the WSOP circuit, including one in the Pot Limit Hold'em, Pot Limit Omaha event in Chester, Pennsylvania, just a few weeks ago. Last summer here at the Rio, he finished 10th in the $1,500 No Limit Hold'em shootout event at the WSOP. And he's very busy with his coaching career. I understand you have moved to Toronto. Is that true?
That's correct, yes. I moved to Toronto, like a lot of my peers, to continue playing poker.
How's that going?
It's great. It's interesting because I tell everyone I left Las Vegas to continue my career as a poker professional. And but it's going great. Just small correction. My final table last year was in the Limit Hold'em shootout.
Oh, I apologize.
Yeah, not a big deal. But I love it up there. I've been satelliting to places all around the world on PokerStars and getting to play tournaments in places that I've never played before. And just be able to play online is great.
What have you noticed between pre-Black Friday and now, the difference for the online game? Has it improved? Is it bigger games, smaller games? Well, what's been the difference?
The noticeable difference is the obvious one, the lack of full tilt. You know, they were the second biggest site. So, when we're talking about tournaments, it's real important to have not just one or two sites that offer tournaments, but have a wide array of them that they are all different, and they all can develop their own player pools. So the lack of full tilt's a big difference. But skill-wise, you know, I think immediately after Black Friday, the skill got a lot softer. And, yeah, basically, with all the pros not being able to play, of course, you know, there were American weak players that weren't, but without the American pros, that was a big difference in the high-stakes tournaments. Over time, a lot of these pros have moved out, and obviously the weaker players aren't moving out. And so I don't think it's gotten tougher yet, because there's still a lot of players that weren't able to move, but it's getting up to the level that it was, and it's not really noticeably softer.
Yeah, I would think not having the American recreational player in the mix has made it a completely different ball game for you. I mean, sure, you've got the European and Latin American and Asian players who are still there on global sites like PokerStars or Party Poker, but taking the millions of Americans who used to just casually throw their money onto these sites out of there changes things.
That's a good point, except that it's already, ever since 2006, the casual recreational player has had a really hard time depositing money on online. Mm. So they've already, it's been a slow, gradual drop with the amount of American players. So by the time 2011 came and Black Friday, there weren't a lot of casual American players left.
Wow.
I always used to portray that the average American player was more experienced, a little higher skilled and everything than the other people in the world. Europe was a little behind them, Latin America a little behind them. Unfortunately, after Black Friday, these guys were only maybe a couple of years behind in development, and they're rapidly catching up. I think if they ever get this through, which they will eventually, to make it to where the U.S. players can again play online, they're going to be surprised when they go back in there. These guys are pretty good online anymore, from what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I mean, it will take a few years for everyone to catch up. But, you know, the top players, I think we're going to start noticing it maybe, you know, by next year at the World Series and things like that. I think you're going to, you know, a few years ago we started noticing, you know, young players like, you know, Dan Kelly and Jason Somerville and a whole bunch of people win bracelets that, you know, 5-6 years ago no one had heard of them. You know, you never would have guessed they were teenagers, you know. Some of them were. and I think that's going to start happening, where you're going to find, you know, players from, you know, from Europe, Latin America, Asia, Australia, that get really good and kind of take, you know, the World Series by storm in the next few years.
Now, we've mentioned Latin America a couple of times. You were there recently for an LAPT event. And because I follow you on Twitter, I know that there was a slight problem that came up, which Dennis and I actually did not have a chance to talk about on the show.
I have no idea what this is about.
So tell Dennis and our audience what happened here and your take on it.
Okay, so I'm playing the Latin America Poker Tour $2,500 main event. And
where was this? What country?
This was in Uruguay.
Okay. Have you been to Uruguay? Was that one of the countries you went to?
Yes, yes, I was. Where were you at?
Punta del Este.
Punta del Este?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I've been down there.
Okay, great. So it's, you know, it's a really nice resort town and all that.
Yeah.
And, well, I raced to 750, blinds to 150, 300. I've got kings. And the guy to my left calls, at least for right now he calls, folds around to a third player who announces raise and then starts thinking. While he's thinking, hasn't said an amount, just he's announced raise, a third player not in the hand points out that the caller, who we all thought threw out 1-500, 2-100 chips, and 2-25 chips for 750, one of the 100 chips was really a 5,000 chip. They looked very similar, so it makes sense making that mistake.
Yep. That would make that a $5,650 bet in my world.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So you'd think it makes a 5,650, and then the next player announced raise. Well, sorry, but you know, the minimum raise is 4,000 more, or whatever, 4,800, and
right.
It's a really good situation for the other guy who's got kings.
You're actually now salivating and thinking, I'm going to get it all in.
Yeah, and either way, it's great. You know, yeah. I mean, there's starting stack was either 20 or 25,000, so or maybe 50, whatever it was. So there's a ton of chips out there, and I mean, this is already, you know, towards the end of day one, but it's still the beginning of the tournament. So, you know, getting in, I might have had 25 or 30,000 to get 15,000 dead money.
Well, yeah, because your bonds are, what, 153. They're still at a low level. You aren't even playing serious poker yet, hardly.
Exactly, exactly. So, one of the problems there was the dealers were just completely clueless and very inexperienced, and they just don't deal poker. And, you know, I don't play. It's too expensive, really, to fly out dealers, you know, especially for only a $2,500 tournament. Together with some sides, but well, the problem with that is okay. So immediately, I'm just like, okay, floor needs to come. They'll clear it all up. The floor is this guy Mike Ward, who supposedly has, you know, been around the industry for a while.
He's
American.
He's a tournament director.
He's a tournament director. Yeah, exactly. So or the tournament director, whatever.
Yeah.
So you know, the head honcho comes over, who seems knowledgeable. I've had some interactions with him. He's kind of on top, especially for a place like that where no one's on top of their game, so he seems fine and all that. Well, he decides to make a ruling in the fairness, in the spirit of being fair, in the fairness of the game. He says that the guy who raised to 5650 obviously did not mean to raise, and therefore I'm going to let him take back his 5000 chip and make that a call, and then the next guy has to raise.
And you are, all of a sudden, the happy feet that you had are not quite dancing as much.
Yeah, I'm not nearly as happy.
All right, now I'm going to stop you there because I'm curious about this. Here you are, you're in a situation where you have a monster.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to make it completely obvious to the guy who's to raise.
Yeah.
He has to raise and he hasn't announced an amount. You don't want to make it completely obvious that whatever he does, you're getting him all in. Or making a monster four bet.
I love my hand, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So basically, you think you have the best hand.
Yeah.
So
period.
When Mike comes over and makes this ruling, do you argue with him?
In my mind, I toss it up real quickly. But then I'm like, there's too much value in getting the right ruling. And also, I couldn't imagine that there's any other ruling. I mean, I've played poker for years, and I'm sure you guys have. It's always a raise. When you put out multiple chips, it's 99% of the time it's an accident.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no question that it's an accident most of the time. And every tournament director makes the ruling that, okay, you're responsible for your own chips. It's not like, you know, I could understand maybe 5 minutes into the tournament they look the same. I mean, we've been playing for 4 or 5 hours already. You're responsible for your own chips. I don't really, you know, it seems so clear to me.
So did you say something like that to Mike?
Yeah, so I really went, you know, just full out trying to make my case, but in a respectful kind of way, and I don't think Mike would have any qualms with the way I argued it. He just wouldn't budge. And I,
okay, well, so then the guy's call stands at 750.
Yeah.
The next guy?
The next guy. So it's actually interesting. Like, he only has to make a minimum raise of 450 more. I've raised from 300 to 750.
Yeah.
So he only has to make a 1,200. I've given, I mean,
yeah.
I couldn't have been more clear that I have the nuts. And yet he makes it 2,500.
Really?
Yeah.
That's almost scary.
So,
oh, my gosh.
You know what? This is actually my favorite part of the story.
Okay.
Because, A, you get the guy who called isn't paying close enough attention, but now the other guy is really not paying close enough attention to pick up what's going on at the table. Unless he has aces in that situation.
And even still, like, you kind of, you know, you have to play that role. It's such a perfect role. Like, if I'm bluffing in that spot, like, doing the whole fake, I'm going to raise there, and if not, I'm going to raise there. So if you have aces, you know, either way, it's like I'm screaming,
yeah.
I have the nuts.
Yeah, but if he has aces, it might be a decent angle shot to do it that way. Not really an angle shot, but a decent strategy move, because he knows you're going to come over the top, and so now he's going to make it more than 1,200.
He's going to
You know, he's going to 3.5 exit, and now you're going to have to make it, you know, 6,000 or more, and then he's going to be able to move in on you. If he has aces, maybe that's the way to do it.
Not the way I'd do it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So either way, yeah, he didn't have aces. Because he folded, and I four bet.
He made it 2,500, and what did you do?
I think I four bet to 55 or 6,000,
uh-huh,
something like that, and they both folded.
So you ended up taking a nice pot, anyhow. Down, it could have been bigger.
Yeah.
You could have also. He could have had the 8, 9 of clubs and flushed out.
Yeah,
I mean, who knows? Whatever.
The guy that had, you know, attempted to call and threw out the extra chip, he was just like this crazy. very loose, crazy player. And
was it an angle shot? Maybe.
No. It was a mistake. But he had maybe 15,000 to start the hand, and
oh wow,
it was very, very unlikely. Like if he did have 9-8 suited, and he had been forced to put in the 57-50, the other 10,000 were going to be going in.
It was
a really rough spot. And then in addition, as if to really throw salt on the wound, he doubled up twice off of me as the day progressed. Both times I had the best hand. And
wow.
Yeah.
He sucked out on you twice?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well,
now I just want to go over this for our audience who don't know, because you and I have played a lot of tournaments. I play a lot of cash games. And in both circumstances, when that happens, whatever you put out there, that stands as your bet. And I told the story on the show a couple of months ago after the circuit event in St. Louis that I was playing. The blinds were 100, 200. I had raised an early position to 400. And in St. Louis, in the tournament chips, the hundreds are black, but the 500s are a dark purple that are easily confused. Mm. And a guy I know threw it out there. He thought that I had made it 800. So he called 800, thinking that that's what I had done. Then it came around to a third player. After he looked at it, he then looked out and said, oh, you only made it 400? Oh, well, okay, made it 800. Then another player then smooth called, and I knew this other player, and I don't really want to be in a hand with him, so I just shoved, took down the 1600 or whatever it was in chips, and you know the guy next to me actually said, "Well, who didn't see that coming?" And I said, "Well, that guy over in C1, the overcaller, obviously didn't see that."
Yeah.
But that's a situation where everybody at the table knew. Well, he made the mistake putting it 800 instead of 400, but too bad.
Yeah.
Here's my problem with that, and I know Mike. I know him very well, and he is a very good tournament director. They have their tournament director's guide that Matt Savage helped put together.
Yep.
Everybody's been involved in it. The very first paragraph of that book talks about the integrity and preserving the integrity and the intent of the game.
Yeah.
And it does give them wide scope of power to make decisions. So, you know, if he walks over there and sees it's an honest mistake or it's early in the tournament, I mean, there are times when I've actually seen them allow him to take that bet back. My problem with it is there was action afterwards.
Right.
And another guy announced raise. Now you've got a big, big problem, because it's not just that the guy accidentally threw him out there and that wasn't what I intended, and you come over there and nobody else has done anything, whatever. You have a raise behind it. That makes it extremely questionable of being able to pull that back.
He made the case that because of that, it would be just compounded. It would be so unfair to both players to have, you know, so in the fairness of to have two people when clearly, and, you know, from the fair, I can make some, it just seems to me like I completely agree that tournament directors should have the fair, you know, they should be able to use their discretion to institute fairness. I've seen it applied a number of times,
yep.
And it's great, and it's good that they don't have to listen to the rules 100% by the book. Mm-hmm. But this wasn't a fairness situation. This is one of the situations that happened hundreds of times, mm-hmm. and should just be a very clear ruling. That you're responsible, amateur, pro alike. Like, it's unfortunate, but that's what happens. And
you know, the next time I'm in a tournament and somebody hits a two-outer on me, I'm going to go to the tournament director and say, you know what, in the best interest of poker, I should still be in there.
Yeah.
There you go. We're all going to get a get-out-of-jail-free card so that when you get sucked out on, you get to re-enter or something. I don't know.
Before we let you go, Ari, the event you played in Chester on the circuit was the Pot Limit Hold'em, Pot Limit Omaha event. Only had 95 people in it. Now, Chester traditionally has trouble drawing big fields, but that's a pretty small field even for any other circuit event. Maybe they're the only ones who are doing a PLH, PLO event. I don't know. Do you like small field events like that, or would you rather play like the one you and I played in St. Louis? The main event there had something like, you know, 900 people in it.
Yeah, I mean, I love bigger events, so if given the choice, I would have played, you know, I'd rather it gets 950 players than 95, but that's what I got.
Even though the 95 gives you a better shot at getting a ring or a bracelet?
I mean, maybe a bracelet, I, you know, could see that. And there's a little bit, it's, you know, there's some what we call ring equity or bracelet mm-hmm. equity, but it's not worth that much more compared to, like, if you had 900 players in the field.
Yeah.
The average level, you know, there's not 900 good pot limit those two games in driving distance to Philadelphia, you know.
he said that very politely.
Yes, he did.
Well handled.
So yeah. he's using prize pool over ring equity. I understand that.
Well, yeah. You realize there's a tournament here called the One Drop that's only going to have like 40 players.
Yeah.
You know, see, there you go.
Yeah.
Real good chance to win a bracelet.
That's a good point. Well, yeah. Ari, good luck with the rest of your series. Thank you so much for coming back on the show. It's always a pleasure
really
to see you.
Thanks so much.
I guess next year we'll probably see you on the circuit again.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. Although I heard St. Louis got sold, so I don't know how that's...
Yeah, but there are non-Caesars properties that have circuit events, so it's possible that we'll still have one.
Yeah.
We don't know. In the meantime...
I always like that stop, so I hope they do.
Cool.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Get a plug in for your training site.
AriAngle.com. Check it out. Contact me after the World Series. I can't do anything for a little while. Trying to win one of those infamous bracelets.
A-R-I-E-N-G-E-L. AriAngle.com. Great
Thanks
to see
so much.
You.
All right. Well done.
Okay, appreciate it.
Our guest today is Asad Ghadarzi, who started playing poker as an undergraduate at Boston University and worked on his game until he was doing well enough to be hired as a teaching pro for Blue Fire Poker, where he's the high stakes and the six max specialist. A couple of years ago, he used some of his winnings to open a restaurant in Boston called, what's the name of the restaurant?
It's called Souse.
Souse? All righty. And now he's here for the WSOP. Welcome to the final table.
Thanks for having me.
How's the restaurant going?
It's going well. We just got a beer license going in Boston. It's summer. We got some ice cream. We're going to be putting on the waffles, and looks like we're in good shape for the summer.
Okay. Asad was telling me before we went on the air, French fries and Belgian waffles, plus all their sauces. That's the restaurant.
No kidding.
That's right.
Okay, I love food, as you can tell, so no problem. Whereabouts in Boston is it located?
We're in the Faneuil Hall area, downtown, like near the financial district.
Oh, good area to be in.
Yeah, really, really nice area. So, Belgian waffles and French fries.
Yeah.
And cool.
French fries, actually, Belgian. They were invented there, not in France.
That's right.
Why, a few years ago when we had that whole freedom fries thing in Congress, remember that? They didn't understand. Because see, they were angry at France. They didn't understand they were actually invented in Belgium. They should be called Belgian fries, like the Belgian waffle.
All right. So, if you tuned in to listen to poker, sorry, guys. We're talking food.
Welcome back to the Food Network.
All righty. Anyhow.
Asad, you played in one of the new events this year here at the WSOP, the 3K No Limit Hold'em PLO heads-up event. You are a heads-up specialist. How was it to play in that event? It's new this year.
Yeah, it was really fun, actually, in relation to the tournaments that I've played in the past that have been, like, nine-handed and so slow. I had a really good time playing this tournament, even though I busted out in the third round on the first day. It was a little strange because, actually... The first round, like 80% of the field got a bye, but I actually ended up playing, which I thought was fine, and I got some practice and got a good idea for the blind structure and stuff. And, yeah, I thought it was a really interesting tournament. Got to play a lot of hands.
How do they do it? How do they switch it from No Limit Hold'em to PLO? Because sometimes they'll do it where it goes every level. Sometimes it goes every round. In a heads-up thing, every round is every two hands.
Right.
Yeah, it was every 20 minutes. So we would switch back and forth, and we started with No Limit, which is my specialty, and then we switched to PLO, which I've played a decent amount of this year and, you know, got my feet wet a little bit.
You know, I was going to ask that, because last year here at the series, you only played No Limit Hold'em events.
I did, yeah.
So how was the PLO part of a No Limit Hold'em PLO heads-up thing like this?
It was fun. It was fun to be able to play a lot of hands. I mean, there's very little folding in PLO, so pretty much take a lot of flops and...
Yeah. I was going to bring that up. I would imagine there's a huge difference between the two. You know, 20 minutes, you're sitting there, you're folding a lot, you're, you know, not as much action, I would guess. And the PLO, you're probably seeing almost every flop, right?
Yeah, basically.
Huge difference in it for a heads-up match. And I would think the variance in PLO heads-up is huge. I
mean, sure.
If you get where you think you're a 60-40 favorite, are you shoving in there?
If the situation calls for it and the stacks are right, definitely, yeah. I mean, there's certain situations where you just aren't allowed to fold mathematically. But, I mean, tournament life is a consideration in some of these cases, and that definitely came up a couple times. But, yeah, for the most part, I mean, you're getting stacks in pretty often. So. Yeah.
Now, I know in other events where they've done heads-up tournaments, it's been 2 out of 3. But this time it was single elimination. You play one round against somebody who you've been picked randomly to play against a draw. You play them, and when your stack is gone, you're done. Or when their stack is gone, you move on to round two, right?
That's true.
But didn't they have lammers?
Yeah, there were three buy-ins.
So if you could explain that, because it's a little bit of difference. It's still best, you know, it's not two out of three, but you had the Lammers, so you did have a backup.
So you basically have three bullets that you can buy in any time. I chose personally to buy in for two, just so I could play a little deep no limit and, you know, have my edge, my no limit edge in the first 20 minutes. And then bought on if I needed to after that. But I thought it was cool to have three different shots, basically, because people played it really differently. Some people bought in all three right away, and other people, you know, did three little ones and played short for most of it. So it's kind of to each his own.
Yeah, I can agree with that. And to me, it would look like if you've got the three Lammers, then you basically got, like you said, two or three bullets, and if you get a cooler, if you get sucked out on, whatever, you still got something to fall back on.
Yeah.
So it's almost like a two out of three.
Yeah, basically. Semi. I mean, it gives you that, like, more tournament life if you want to hold on to one of those.
And so when you buy in all WSOP events, you get triple your buy-in in chips. So a 1,000 event, you get 3,000 in chips. This was a 3,000 buy-in, so you got 9,000 in chips, but it was really 3,000, 3,000, 3,000, right?
Exactly. And you had the option to buy in with those 3,000 anytime you wanted.
Okay.
Except for in the middle of a hand.
All right. Well, we're getting into a lot of detail here, but I'm curious because this is a brand new event and I don't know how they did it. Did it start out at 25-25 blinds?
It was 25-50 to start.
Okay. Now, I play a lot of PLO, and I know that if you bought into a PLO game where the blinds were 25-50 and you only had 3,000 in front of you, it's not going to take that many hands before all your chips are in the middle.
Yeah, exactly.
That seems like a really short stack PLO game at that point. So were you trying to – I mean, how do you manage your chips between the 20 minutes of no limit hold'em, which you're really good at, and the 20 minutes of pot limit hold'em, which you might just be good at? How are you managing that, especially when the chances of getting it in the PLO round are so high?
Right. I mean, I definitely took that risk with buying in for two of my shots early to try to kind of, like, increase my advantage in no limit. But – you know, you just have to kind of work with what you got, and I decided to save one of my chips for the third round when we got back to no limit so I could buy deep, and that's pretty much how it went. I managed to run good in the first PLO round, both of my first matches, so
no.
I didn't have to deal with that. But, it was definitely an interesting tournament, and I look forward to playing again next year.
Well, brand new one for the WSOP. They're always trying to tweak and change things. Do you see any... Should there maybe be a longer session for the no limit versus the PLO because there's so much action in the PLO? Do you see any way to change it that you think might help improve it for next year?
That's a good question, actually. I didn't really put much thought into that, but I think that just making the levels longer in general would be more fun, and you could kind of like get better reads on your opponent that way because the hands are, I mean, you don't play very many hands, obviously, when you're playing live, and the dealers aren't always shuffling it up that fast.
Yeah.
You know? I think that having longer levels would definitely make for more interesting matches.
Okay. And did the blinds go up every level or
every
two
level?
Level?
Every level, yeah.
So even when you switched from no limit to PLO, the blinds went up?
Yeah, exactly.
Wow, that gets up there fairly quick.
It was, at one point I was playing, and my first match lasted almost 3 hours, and I was like one of the last people left, you know, in the room. And we were playing, like, effective stacks were like six big blinds, seven
oh
big
my
blinds.
Gosh.
It was like crazy,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, let's talk a little bit about coming in as a guy who is a heads-up specialist and a six-max specialist. When you play in a big event here at the WSOP, you're sitting down in a full ring, 9, maybe 10 in some of these events. How is that? How hard is that for you and for other shorthanded pros to play full ring games? How do you shift gears for that?
Yeah, I think it's pretty natural for us as shorthanded specialists to want to play loose and kind of want to be involved in every pot, but ultimately we have to just realize and adapt, and you know, you realize that everybody's ranges are just tight, and nine-handed especially, like, everybody's just going to have much stronger hands in general, so you got to be patient, and that's one of the main adjustments that I think online players have a hard time making. But, you know, I'm only going to be playing six-handed events this year, six or less.
Oh, so. You're not going to play full ring?
No, I can't do it to myself.
Is that because you just don't have the patience for it, having been an online player who's used to seeing stuff flash in front of you and playing hands all the time?
I just don't like to fold. I don't know
I
what it is.
I love it.
Well, you play to your strength, and his strength is the shorter
Absolutely.
Table. Absolutely.
And it's important to know that.
Quick question then, because they have another new one here where you start out with a full ring, then you go to six max, then you go to heads up.
Are
you
mixed.
The mix max.
The mix that's today, actually.
Yeah, are you going to play that?
I'm not going to play that. No, I'm actually heading home. But I think that's a cool tournament for sure.
Yeah.
So if you get past that first round, like, definitely there's a lot of advantage to be had with the shorthanded specialists. When it gets, basically it's like a nine-handed sit and go.
Okay.
And then, yeah.
Maybe for our viewers then, since you play with a smaller number of people, what is your opening hands now? I mean, how wide do you spread it out there? Basically, any two cards is possible to open if you're in position?
Heads up, you mean?
No, four-handed or six-handed.
It depends a lot on the table, and that's kind of like a cop-out answer.
Yeah, well.
But, I mean, heads up, for instance, I was opening 100% of buttons, and MPLO was defending almost 100% against min raises, just mathematically.
Yeah.
Four-hand is a little different. It depends, like, if the button is a tough player, then you got to be a little tighter, et cetera, et cetera. It's just kind of like, you know, you make your in-game adjustments based on who's at the table and such.
Now, you do online training, as I mentioned, at Blue Fire Poker for shorthanded play. Most online pros learn that because it's much more action and you don't want to fold and you want to get in there. But a lot of players who are ring game players, the only time they ever get shorthanded action or heads-up action is when they get to the end of a tournament. So what are common mistakes they make when they get there because they don't have the experience of shorthanded and heads-up play that you have?
That's a great point and a great question. I think that a lot of people end up playing too tight. And, you know, there are obviously some ICM things that need to go into consideration. But generally, when somebody's used to playing a certain range in a specific situation and they're all of a sudden faced with, like, much wider ranges and a lot of money on the line, I think that everybody just is not playing loose enough in general. And that's, like, one of the main things that needs to be worked on.
Is it a matter of being loose or being aggressive or both?
Well, loose and aggressive are both really general terms. But it's just a matter of, like, realizing your opponent's ranges in shorthanded scenarios and how they're going to be reacting to yours. So in those situations, you can put a lot of pressure on your opponents as shorthanded or heads-up specialist, whereas I think a lot of these full-ring players have a hard time, you know, doing that, adjusting to that.
Actually, one extreme, I think it was Dan Harrington who said on heads-up, there are no two cards in the deck that you should fold to start with, period. You should play every hand until there's a raise or something like that. He said, if you're coming in, you play every hand, at least.
And at, least. Going,
at least.
At least 100%.
At least 100%.
Not more.
Yeah, there you go. So it's like, wow, okay.
It's
so,
a matter then of how you play them.
Correct.
Well, it's the only way to get a good sense of how your opponents are playing, right?
That's an excellent point. It absolutely is. Because you're playing every hand, you're putting pressure back on your opponent, and you can actually see how he plays.
Right.
I think that's an excellent point.
You mentioned in the 3K No Limit Hold'em, Pot Limit Hold'em event, No Limit Hold'em was your specialty. You were trying to do your best in that and try to get chips as much as you could there because you were better at that than at PLO. Do you play other mixed games?
I don't. I haven't really ventured out into the even PLO. I just started playing this year, and yeah, I've played quite a bit now of heads up PLO, and feel pretty confident.
And now you're a junkie, aren't you?
Yeah,
I find once No Limit Hold'em players dip their toe into the PLO pool, they go, "Wow!" Especially if they're an action player, they go, "Wow, I really like this game." And sometimes they make the move. Have you found yourself doing
that? It's a fun game for sure. Yeah, I'm having trouble actually nowadays playing PLO and No Limit at the same time because then it makes me play really loose at No Limit. Like, I just never fold to three bets. So I got to be careful with that. But
well,
yeah,
we should explain for, you know, and one of my missions this year is to try to get more people to start playing PLO. Not just because I want to have new people at the table, rookies
at
the table.
Yes, you do. Let's be honest. Come on now.
That's part of it. But also because I want to see PLO grow. I think it's already the second most common poker game that people are playing, but I want more people to get out there. So the thing that you have to understand is in PLO, you're going to see a lot more flops than you are in No Limit Hold'em, particularly in position. I mean, if you're in late position in PLO, certainly there are going to be a lot of hands you're going to fold, but your range is so much wider. Your hand selection gives you many more opportunities in PLO than it does in No Limit Hold'em. I know that's true in the cash games that I play. Is that true in tournament play?
Well, I've only played one PLO tournament so far.
Okay.
But I definitely think it's true. I mean, the like theories and concepts behind PLO definitely carry over to tournament play, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, when equities run so much closer preflop and, you know, aces are no longer such a huge favorite against any hand.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the natural thing to do is going to be to call a lot of pre and see what happens.
That's what you can always tell a Hold'em player who's just started playing PLO because they're moaning about their aces, kings, and queens getting cracked. Queens is not a big deal. Sorry.
Yeah.
Right. One thing you mentioned earlier, we had Barry Greenstein on, and he was talking about horse, and he was talking about how people have sometimes have a problem switching between the different games, and they always have a weak one, and you look to see which one they're weak at, whether it's Raz or whatever type deal. You were talking about switching between the No Limit and the PLO, and how you've got to be a little careful there and everything.
Well, when I play them at the same time.
Right.
Like online, I'll be playing a bunch of tables, and sometimes we'll mix in some PLO, and then I can definitely tell that it affects my No Limit game at while I'm playing.
Oh, how many games do you play online at a time, ballpark? Are you a 3 or 4? Are you a 10 or 12? Are you?
I've done everything. Nowadays, I try not to play more than 5, 6, just because I'm playing mostly heads up, and it's tough to mix in heads up and 6 max at the same time. Like sometimes I'll be three tabling someone heads up and then playing 2 or 3 tables 6 max on the side. But when you start throwing PLO in there, it's just starts getting crazy. So I would say somewhere between 3 and 5 is my sweet spot. Sometimes I'll play 8 and then it gets a little crazy. But
I actually played a Raz while I was playing about 3 No Limits a while back. And I kept getting screwed up. I really did. I played horrible Raz. Whoever was there had to think I was the biggest donk around while I was doing this thing. Because I just kept getting it screwed up and I couldn't get my mind straight on it. So I can see what you mean about the mixing them back and forth. I would think if you had a couple of games of No Limit and a couple of games of PLO going at the same time, that could be a nightmare.
Yeah. It's now hard to keep up with.
For our listeners who heard us say that you're from Boston and hear you talking about playing online, we should point out you now live in Toronto. At least most of the time.
I've relocated to Toronto some of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was living in Croatia with some friends for a couple months, and then we decided to get a place in Toronto together, so now we're kind of between Toronto, Vegas, Boston.
All right. Now, we've spoken to a bunch of pros who have moved out of the country to play. What is the online poker environment now without the vast majority of American players in there? Some pros have moved out of the country to do exactly what you're doing, but the recreational players and the vast majority of Americans who used to play on PokerStars or Full Tilt or Ultimate Bet or wherever, they're now not part of the landscape. What's that done to the competitive landscape that you're now playing in?
Well, I think that the games are certainly different than they were a year ago. With the, no American players definitely makes it pretty different. I mean, I would say there were a lot of good American pros that made the games tough, especially at the high stakes. And I know that a lot of them have relocated now, but there's also a plus side in that now we have access to all these European sites that we otherwise wouldn't. And that's kind of made up for the lack of action. I think the games are still good, for sure. I have faith in the longevity of poker, definitely. And especially after the WSOP, maybe we'll have some deals with the Full Tilt and Stars and cross your fingers. I think things are looking pretty good, actually. I'm optimistic about the future.
So if things change in the U.S., you'll be back down here playing, even if it's just the state of Nevada or the state of New Jersey or something like that?
I would like to come back to the U.S. for sure.
All right, cool.
Not that I don't like Toronto. I love it there.
All right, we didn't really get into your training site and what you do there. You want to give us a little background about that? Put a plug in for them.
A plug in for Bluefire?
Yeah.
Well, it's been great so far. I mean, this is my first time producing videos for a training site. I was telling Paul earlier that I've been making videos for a few years now, but haven't really released any. I just do them for my personal review.
Okay.
But I'm basically going to be making high stakes, 6 max, and heads up videos for, the foreseeable future, and I've released 4 already. My latest series is a 4-table match against Sauce 123, who's a very famous high stakes heads up player. So it's been really fun so far, actually, and everybody at Bluefire has been great and really welcoming. and I'm excited to be part of it for sure.
That's Asad Goodarzi, one of the three young pros who joined us a little over a month ago at the beginning of the 2012 World Series of Poker at the Rio in Las Vegas. All here to wrap up this edition of the Final Table Poker Radio Show. For Dennis Phillips, I'm Paul Harris. Thank you for listening. Remember, if you've missed any of our 181 shows or want to hear any specific guest, you can find them all on our website, finaltableshow.com. We hope to talk to you again soon.